We are the space robots. We are here to protect you. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us. Back, Cooey, us.
All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Pusher Robot.
And this is the Shover Robot.
And we're here to protect you from the terrible secret of space. It has been a long time since we had our last podcast, and by that token, I'd like to officially welcome you to Season 2 of Terrible Secrets from Space. Woo!
Woohoo! Season 2! What does that mean? Absolutely.
It means that we had such a long break that I feel like justifying it with an arbitrary season delimiter. So, perfect. All right. Today, we are going to be covering some current event-related jargon, which is long-distance space travel. And we'll be talking about the Hawaiian Mars Isolation Experiments and Proxima B in today's episode, and also some things related to that, which show why we shouldn't be... We should be excited, but we shouldn't be as excited as I think we're getting excited about.
Right. But still be excited. Yeah. Because this is still space and some pretty cool stuff we're talking about.
And you should always be excited about space.
Like, absolutely.
Why are you listening to this if you're not excited about space? Go home. Go. Get out. Get out. Go.
Shoot. And there goes the viewer audience.
Yeah, shoot. All right. So when we're talking long distance space travel, we're, of course, talking about the increasing potential of humans moving out to the stars, specifically because we've got a lot of focus right now on exoplanet research, and we've got a lot of focus on moving out into planets or asteroids in our own solar system. But for the really long, and I mean, even going to Mars is quote unquote a long distance mission because it's not just like a 5-hour car drive. You know, it takes several months to get there with current technology. So long distance, even in our solar system, is a big deal. So being the mostly water flesh bags that we are, we've got a lot of needs that aren't particularly conducive to space. We've covered them in previous episodes for the most part, but the recap is the big four are food, water, oxygen, and heat. Because if we don't have any one of those four things, or if a single one of those is missing, we are so dead. Some quicker than others.
I mean, it can pretty much be boiled down to the survival rule of threes if you're talking about going hiking in the woods, except we kind of take for granted the fact that we've got oxygen all around us here.
Yeah.
So we have to add that little extra bit in when we're talking about space travel. Yeah. You know, food, water, shelter, and oxygen.
So even more long-term than those four very, very important elements is recent experiments that were conducted with Commander Kelly on the space station and with others who have spent long amounts of time in space, is that space does horrible, horrible things to the human body. Specifically, the microgravity of space does horrible things to the human body because our bone growth and our muscle growth was not designed to account for microgravity environments. We were always expecting to have 14 pounds of atmosphere on us at sea level.
Yep, 14 pounds of atmosphere and a constant, cozy 9.8 meters per second squared of acceleration.
Yeah, and when you don't have that, your bones and ligaments tend to atrophy and do some really, really not so good things. And we were able to see that really good in Commander Kelly's experiment where he and his twin brother, was here on Earth and he was up on the space station, and the comparative physiology between the two of them doing, you know, the same kind of tasks and exercises and stuff on a daily basis really shows like how much a human body is strained in space.
Absolutely. But don't despair, space travel enthusiasts, because, you know, traveling long distance, and we're assuming outside of the solar system now, we're going to be probably undergoing some sort of constant acceleratory thrust system, which basically means that you're going to have your gravity in just the form of because you're constantly trying to go faster or slow down to get to somewhere that's far away.
Yeah, unlike getting on a freeway and driving from, you know, coast to coast where you speed up and then you hit 80 miles an hour if you're cool, and you continue going along and then you slow down very much at the end, Most space travel for the distances we're talking, like to the Alpha Centauri, or the Centauri, Proxima Centauri system, and even to places in our own solar system, are the equivalent of traveling in a car from one side of your driveway to another. Like, you're either speeding up or you're slowing down, but you're very, very rarely ever going at a constant speed. Possibly a good example, you know, driving across your driveway is sort of like traveling through space.
Right, just a lot, you know, on a much different scale.
Much different scale.
And a cosmic scale. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And for the record, we don't condone speeding violations. I mean, you know, just so the legal issues, clearly the lawyers needed us to say that.
If you come from Nevada like I do, 80 miles an hour on the freeway is like a minimum. So
this just
might be me. Anyway, so because of all these strains being put on the human body and the necessity of keeping up an environment possibly for, you know, at least months, but very likely for years at a time, we've got some additional options in three or four sets of quotes because they are not yet quite figured out yet. So one of them is the big one, cryosleep, that science fiction movies like to throw out a lot, is the possibility that you just go into a nice convenient rest and you just get woken up when you get to your destination, and therefore the ship doesn't have to maintain an atmosphere, it doesn't have to maintain heat for all of the interior areas, you don't need food, you don't need water, at least not very much of it. So what's the feasibility of doing this?
Yeah, the feasibility of cryosleep is, at least suspended animation, is pretty low right now. We are consistently looking into it. The problem is, unlike most elements or molecules, when you cool things down, they usually shrink, except for water, which is unfortunately, or fortunately, actually, what we're made out of. Water likes to expand, and when you expand water, when it cools, it has a nasty tendency, especially in the formation of ice crystals, of basically destroying all of the cells inside of that. And the living tissue is damaged beyond repair, essentially. It's like worse than radiation kind of stuff. But that's something else to worry about all entirely. But there is hope out there. I mean, we're constantly doing research on extremophiles. That is, organisms that live in extreme heat or extreme cold temperatures, or just something else like a vacuum, perhaps, and seeing how is it that they are able to adapt to that sort of environment, and is there something that we can do to, in some ways, copy that in form of, you know, either DNA? Is there a process, a biological process that go under? Is there something about the chemicals in there? How can we put antifreeze in our bodies? You know, stuff like that, essentially. But cryosleep, as far as freezing somebody, this is very, very difficult. I mean, you hear about people going into cryogenics if they've got, like, some long-term disease that they don't have a cure for. Their hope is that eventually, someday, that they're going to have the technology to unfreeze them without killing them. Because as it stands right now, everyone that's frozen in cryogenics, they're basically stuck there because we don't possess the technology to thaw them out. We don't have the microwave feature that automatically thaws them out. And unfortunately, you might come to the point where, hey, we froze you wrong, and this isn't actually the way to do it, so they're probably just going to be dead. But regardless of the fact, people that are doing that currently are probably going to die anyway, so it's kind of like, well, I try for something, right?
If only we were like tardigrades, you know, just dry yourself out and then just sit in suspended animation. Don't have to worry about radiation. Don't have to worry about freezing temperatures. You know, you're just fine.
Yeah, we're pretty fragile creatures when it comes down to it.
Yeah, and that, in the same vein as cryosleep, is a technology or a theory of sending frozen embryos along spacecrafts, which is a decent idea. It's more safe than cryosleep because you're freezing an early, very, very simple organism, just suspending it and then allowing it to continue developing. But the only problem is that you would have to send somebody else in cryosleep as well, because who is going to do anything with all the embryos when they get to the destination? Like, ain't happening. Unless you had some kind of artificial intelligence or robotic program that allowed them to reach maturity. So,
which is more the likely case in that scenario with the frozen embryos. You're going to have some sort of adaptive programming that's basically set to do, you know, turn on the embryos and let them incubate themselves, which is also technology that we really don't have the ability to do for, you know, moral, ethical reasons or scientific reasons or otherwise. We can't grow human embryos outside of the womb. I think the current longest time we've been able to successfully do it is about 14 days. So, yeah, we ain't quite there yet.
Not quite. So, barring any kind of cryosleep option or sending along frozen embryos, our best option for long-distance mission is generational ships, especially ones that are going to take, you know, more than a decade or almost a century if we're going really far out. Doubtful we'll do anything like that in the near future or possibly ever. We might just wait until we have the technology to traverse large distances relatively quickly before we try to fly farther than any of like the Alpha Centauri or Proxima Centauri systems, because those trips would take decades or centuries with current technology. And undoubtedly you'd have to have some kind of generational ship, which current spaceship design does not support anything of that caliber. Like, spaceships in the present day are an awful place to try to raise offspring.
Right. So this is like more of the Wall-E scenario, if you remember that from that Disney movie where they've got the cruise ship with all the people on the the floating chairs and stuff. That'd be kind of like a generation ship. But you see this a lot in science fiction as well, as something that it's kind of a romantic thing. Oh, you know, we live on this ship and we breed on this ship, and then we're not going to get there, but by golly, our grandkids are going to, you know, be the first humans on, you know, Proxima B or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But with all of these options, I can hear people asking, well, why do we need these things? Why can't we just get there and get there quickly? Because with all these options, I mean, we were talking about decades to centuries of travel time, and that's on the small scale. I mean, that's a pretty short distance given our current technology, and we're gonna hit up on that here soon. So the technology, unfortunately, as far as propulsion and getting us to going places fast, not quite there yet. But there's some interesting things coming around the corner. So let's talk about what we've got and what's coming around.
Yep, seriously. So right now, our best rocket technology basically still lies in solid and liquid propellants. Like, that's about where we're at right now. On the horizon, some things that we've already tested are solar sails. We had a probe try those out last year, I believe, with some success. That is based off of the solar radiation being emitted from a star or other suitable source, basically acting as a wind as it presses up against a sail that's designed to capture and, you know, deflect against that kind of output. And that allows you to start moving very slowly but get going faster over time, which is kind of a running theme in how a lot of this stuff is, or future propulsion methods are trending towards.
Right. And with these energy sails too, and we've talked about them a little bit before briefly, but it's not so much, and it's kind of romantic to think about, hey, we started, you know, when we started exploring humanity, we're on sailing ships, now we're on sailing spaceships, because spaceships makes everything more exciting and romantic. But don't think about, you know, the giant clipper ships and their massive sails. This is more of, I mean, we're talking some serious area here on these sails, hundreds of square kilometers in terms of area on these solar or microwave sails, just to be able to get the amount of thrust and propulsive force you need to carry yourself at any sort of relative velocity or significant velocity.
So in that same vein of start slow but keep going faster and faster is ion engines, which is the theory that you just kind of kick out an ion or very small amounts of ions out of an engine. Think of it as like a really, really, really slow rocket burn. Like, you're producing these on the ship with very, very little amounts of fuel, which is where the advantage comes in, or very little amounts of mass of fuel. And they get kicked out at a constant rate, which, since you're basically just fighting or doing equal and opposite reactions, the really, really small ions coming out over time makes the really, really big spaceship start to move. And we saw this in the book The Martian. That's what was powering the Hermes, was an ion engine, which is also why they were so concerned about it slowing down or speeding up during that whole slingshot maneuver around the Earth, is because once the ion engine gets going, you have to spend a long time stopping it, and you have to spend a long time speeding it back up.
Absolutely. And the downside to ion engines is they're incredibly power hungry. While they propulsively, they have a very high specific impulse, which is exactly what Pusher was saying about, you know, only needing a small amount of fuel. It shoots that small amount of fuel at such a high velocity that you don't need as much of the fuel to get the same amount of thrust, essentially. Whereas with, for instance, chemical rockets, you're sending a lot of material out at a relatively slower speed. But to do that, you're talking about some very, very high-powered magnets, electromagnets, and you end up using force. So the best viability option of this right now, which is still kind of in testing, is the Vasimir. And that means it's variable specific impulse magnetoplasma rocket. And if you say that 10 times fast, you get a gold star for trying if you don't. But
yeah.
Vasimir is interesting because it's a more efficient version of the ion engine. Even still, a 200 kilowatt engine only produces about 5 newtons of thrust, which a newton of thrust, essentially, you know, you're using the metric system here. So 1 newton of thrust is a force equal to the approximation of 1 kilogram traveling at 1 meter per second squared. And that's how that whole system works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So ion engines, good in theory. We're still not quite there on developing them, but they are one of the fringe technologies that were really close. So it's possible we might see application of that in future satellites, probably spaceships, unlikely, but we'll see where it goes.
Oh yeah, and we've got electric satellites out there right now using these things. It's
yeah.
just not as powerful.
Yeah, not on the scale that we're talking here. So the next one is one that we've talked about a lot, but we love it, was the old Project Orion, kick a nuclear bomb out the back of the spaceship and ride the explosion, which is both awesome and stupid dangerous.
Yeah, and, atomic surfing.
Yeah. So we've talked about that, but that is certainly an option for long-distance space flights. You can get going pretty fast in a pretty short amount of time. Using bombs. Slowing down, I think, is going to be a little bit more difficult because you'll be kicking bombs out in front of you and hoping that they explode far enough in front that you can hit a safe part of the shockwave. But, you know.
Yeah, but we got physicists to figure that stuff out. Physicists and and mathematical calculations can do that for us. The problem is going to be in the physical problem is going to be you being inside the container, getting shooken around like a, I don't know, a soda can on a by some little twerpy kid.
Yeah, soda can and a rock grinder.
Golly, it's yeah. Polishing. I mean, we're talking about a positive 3 or 4 G's followed by a negative 1 G acceleration on like an amplitude cycle of approximately, I think it's like 4 seconds or 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. So if you can imagine being thrown forward and then thrown back over and over again, it's kind of hard on the human body.
Yeah.
But again, hey, it's something that we can use. Maybe we use it for a drone or a probe or some sort, but where's the fun in that?
Yep. And the last one, of course, is stuff of Star Trek, definitely not quite there, is matter-antimatter reactions, antimatter rockets, using the annihilation of matter versus antimatter to power a spaceship in some fashion. In Star Trek, it's aligned through a dilithium crystal chamber to produce a warp effect somehow. In practice, you can make a really big boom with it, and making a really big boom in a specific direction is how we power rockets all over the world. So that's right. Probably more a practical application.
Yeah.
But antimatter is difficult to produce, and it is difficult to store safely. And unless you like riding on even more of a giant bomb than you're already riding on when you're doing space travel, antimatter is probably not the best option.
Nope, but it is exciting, and in real life, there are people actually working on this right now, and they're not just evil scientist types. Antimatter, or the positron, in most cases that people are talking about antimatter, it's anything that's, you know, or mirror matter, it's the opposite charged particle of the normally occurring proton or electron, and so you have antiprotons and anti-electrons, or positrons, in that case. And so, the positron is the most common of those, and those are actually spun off of nuclear reactions. And so you can actually get positrons and antimatter from a byproduct of just a regular occurring nuclear power plant or something of that sort. And so the way that works is essentially no dilithium crystals involved here, but you basically get a electron and a positron, and then they smash into each other and they produce 200% of the thrust, because both of those particles are converted into energy at that point as they annihilate one another. And what's exciting about that is essentially you use the same amount of mass, but you get double for what you put into it. And electrons are almost free. Positrons you have to work for a little bit more, but you get this large propulsive efficiency. The awesome thing about this is it's if you can upscale that reaction, because right now we're talking about like less than a newton of thrust with the things that we have currently in experimentation, which is very, very, very small amounts of thrust. Mouse farts worth of thrust, to quote my good favorite Dr. Fabian. But still, probably the best hope for getting somewhere quickly, especially with humans involved, because ion engines just aren't going to cut it, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute.
Yeah. So, well, if you want to talk about propulsion, now would be a good time. I'm going to talk about equipment fabrication.
All right.
Going on here. So, go on your tangent. You can do it.
All right. The tangent of... the tangent. Here we go. All right. So, we want to talk propulsion here. All right. Let's play some math. So let's talk about going to Proxima Centauri. So if we want to get to Proxima Centauri, and this is the whole point of why I really want to have a warp drive, you're going to find out soon why. Going to Proxima Centauri, let's say, and this is going to assume that we've already, our magical experimental spacecraft has already reached escape velocity of Earth, which is approximately 11,200 meters per second. And we need to travel 4 times 10 to the 16 meters, which is roughly the distance to Proxima Centauri. Okay, so the ideal way to get there, so let's say about the fastest way to get there with the person involved that's alive. So let's burn at a constant acceleration of 9.8 meters per second. That's going to give you a nice comfortable 1G all the way there. It's going to take you, at that acceleration, it's going to take you about 2.8 years to get there. Hey, that's not so bad, you think to yourself, but that you're just going to whiz right past it, and you're not even going to be able to stop. So, to be more realistic, traveling at that same acceleration, you're going to accelerate halfway there. When you reach the halfway point, you're going to turn around, and you're going to blast your engines in the other direction so that you're accelerating in the other direction, so that you can slow down and have a net acceleration trade-off of zero, basically, so you can be in orbit around the Proxima Centauri once you get there. Doing that's going to take you roughly 4 years. Okay, so to put that in quick perspective, it takes you 4 years to get there via this method, and Proxima Centauri is approximately 4 years light years away. And so when you get there, you send a message that says, hey, we made it. That's going to take 4 years to travel to Earth. Earth's going to go, awesome, they made it. And they're going to send a message saying, good job, and that gets back. By that time, you've already been at Proxima Centauri for 8 years. So that's a whole other sort of logistical nightmare of communication. But let's assume that maybe we figured out quantum entanglement at that time, which is probably realistic considering the technologies that you need to even get there in the first place. Okay, so okay, let's go faster. So let's say we just figure out a way to make a human being sustain 3 Gs of acceleration, which is roughly 30 meters per second squared. Okay, now it's only going to take you 2 years and 4 months to get there. Okay, but that's still a long time, and that's a lot of G's to experience your entire way there. So maybe that's something we use with cryogenics or something to kind of pad the body or some way produce it so that it's not going to get completely smushed and deformed in that high G environment for 2 years and 4 months straight of 3 Gs. Okay, so then I was like, all right, cool, that's exciting. That's in the realm of feasibility, but what do we have right now? What can we do? All right. So I was chose to use the Vasimir system. So the Vasimir system, as you know, it's a 200 kilowatt engine, puts out about 5 newtons. So I'm like, okay, cool, sweet. Let's assume we've got these to the point where we use them a lot, and we need to get someplace quick. Well, how much power do we have available to us is really the limiting factor. And so right now I'm like, all right, cool. What do we got for power plants? It's going to be nuclear because you can't do anything else in space really very very efficiently. So I went and looked up, and it's the I'm going to butcher this, so apologize if you're of Japanese descent and I say it's completely wrong, but the Kashiwazaki Kariwa nuclear power plant in Japan puts out roughly 8,000 megawatts of power capacity. So we're going to use that as our example. So using that gives us about 40,000 Vasimir engines, which put about 5 newtons of thrust each, and if you do the math, it's roughly 200,000 newtons of thrust. So completely ignoring the fact that the power plant's going to weigh a whole bunch of weight, and ignoring the massive amount of propellant that you're going to need to use this on this trip. For scaling, one of these engines uses approximately 9 tons of propellant on a round trip to the moon and back to Earth orbit. So it's not an insignificant amount of thrust. These engines still use quite a bit of material, just a lot less than a conventional chemical rocket. Okay, so then I'm saying, all right, let's get there and let's use the weight of a probe. So I used Voyager 2. So we're just going to assume we're going to send Voyager 2 on this magic rocket, which weighs almost nothing, all the way out to Proxima Centauri using these Vazimir thrusters. Okay. So weighing in at approximately 825 kilograms, you're going to be able to accelerate with that Newton, with that amount of thrust, approximately 241 meters per second squared, which is roughly equivalent to 24 Gs. Okay, so bear that in mind. 241 meters per second. To get there, this is going to be the accelerating halfway there and the decelerate the other half, is going to take you 298 days. Hey, that's kind of in the realm of feasibility, you know? It's less than a year. But again, I caution, big bold letters here, we completely ignored the fact that we just hauled a nuclear power station into low Earth orbit, which weighs, oh my gosh, I don't even want to think about it, how much mass that is. And we also negated all of the fuel involved in this this orbital transfer for that Delta V, as well as we're assuming that we're just sending Voyager 2. So it's possible, yes, sort of, but we're talking about some massive amounts of power. And I'm quite convinced, too, if we did take into consideration the weight of the power plant and all the propellant it would need, that it's going to take a much longer time. You're not going to be able to accelerate nearly that quickly. And so really, to get anywhere in any amount of time, we're going to need a warp drive, in which case, you know, we're kind of throwing science at the wall and saying, hey, we need to get through space by traveling between space, or by some ways making space-time warp around us. But that's a topic for another time.
Yeah, you remember at the beginning of the episode when I said don't get too excited? This the math is why. the math is always why. All right. So with that in mind, the last thing that you really, or at least the last major thing that you really want to think of, is when you take a spaceship from one destination to another, guaranteed something's going to break, because that's just the way that life is. When something breaks, are you going to have a replacement part on hand that you just brought up from your departure area, or are you going to be able to make it? And the obvious answer is make it, because the more stuff you have to send into orbit, the more expensive the mission is, the more space you need to have on the craft, increasing the expense, the more rocket fuel you need to have to push the craft, more expense. So it goes up. Everything just compounds on top of each other. So equipment manufacture in space is a huge deal for the success of long-term missions. And we've got a few things that are in the works that could be used to solve this problem. The first one is metal sintering, which is currently being researched as a possible way of making habitats on places like the moon that have appropriate materials in the soil and readily available. Won't work on every situation, but it's basically the concept of gently almost melting chunks of metallic compounds until they form brittle and sturdy walls or other just sheets that you can use to construct shielding or structures or what have you. There's other fabrication methods that are like trying to use materials that you find out in space, basically jumping from one point to another, island hopping, as it were, to pick up, you know, iron from asteroids or other components that you would need in order to create the tools or replacement parts that you would require.
And mind you, by the way, that the interstellar space between solar systems is very, very, very devoid of material, as far as we know at this time. I mean, past the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt, I mean, you're looking at a whole lot of nothing. Like, even the hydrogen in between the space, for if you want to do something like a Bessard ramjet, which is something else we'll talk about, not in this episode, though, it's very sparse.
Yeah. And like before, we've talked about the concept of perhaps taking an asteroid mostly composed of iron, hollowing out a little bit of the inside and then superheating it and then inflating it to make a spaceship, which would provide you easy access to a lot of ferrous materials in general and pretty much anything else you can scrape off an asteroid, depending on what kind you get and what it was made out of at conception, which is also a possibility for having those kind of supplies ready and on hand. But once again, it's a little bit difficult with current technology to blow up an asteroid like a balloon in orbit.
Just a little.
Just a little. And over all of this entire discussion is something that is referred to as the weight calculation, which is probably the single biggest thing that is stopping us from just, you know, to hell with it. Let's pull a 1960s and just throw people into space and see what happens kind of attitude. And that's the weight calculation, which is the concept that technology is advancing at such a pace and things in space are so far away that at a certain point of how long the mission is going to be, it's not worth it to send somebody because within the amount of time that they're traveling, we will have developed a faster ship that will allow them to pass the people who are currently traveling to the location. And currently that is capping it at about a 50-year maximum for missions, last time I checked, where if it's going to take longer than that to send somebody somewhere, just don't do it, because we're going to have technology that will send them faster and make the original mission moot, basically.
So essentially, you send up this original mission, if it takes more than 50 years, by the time that mission gets halfway through, they're going to have already developed another breakthrough in propulsion technology, which allows the ship to go even faster. And so here comes generation ship number one, putting along here in the slow lane, and then about their halfway point, they're going to be zoomed past by the ship number two, which is using the new propulsion systems. And that's kind of where we're getting at, kind of being a waste of time here for anyone to try to do anything that takes longer than a 50 years. And this is kind of where the hopeful part is, too. This is not the despair part, because you think about human spaceflight and just the exciting and just the innovation behind it. I mean, we've only been doing this for a couple decades, and flight in general, just flying, powered flight itself, has only been around for just over 100 years. And so when you think about how far we've come in just that short amount of time, 50-year feasibility, basically, and also technology is increasing on an exponential scale, not just a linear scale. 50 years from now, who knows what we've got available? I mean, we could very much have warp technology, yeah. And that would be cool. I don't know how it's going to work. I don't know how they're going to do it, but man, that would be awesome. Fun to think about.
Yeah, it's the fact that that calculation exists at all is just the most important thing of that we're expecting with our current estimations that we're going to be leaping forward so fast that it's almost better to wait to see what we come up with than to just throw resources at something now. So even though it might look like we're not doing a whole lot in terms of exoplanet exploration, rest assured that we are doing a lot, but we just don't want to throw our money into bad places, basically.
Yeah, we're going to try and focus in on getting us back to the moon, going into Mars, and kind of exploring our solar system, improve the technologies there before leaping outside of that, this nice little comfort zone.
So we're running short on time, but we still have a couple more topics here. The first one is, where would we go, assuming that we were to leave our solar system? There are several choice parts, and I guess we got to talk about the elephant in the room, which is Proxima Centauri B, which was just discovered announced last week, I believe, maybe 2 weeks ago now, which is a planet 4.2 light years away. It's, I believe, our closest neighbor. Proxima Centauri system, and we just discovered a planet which is a little bit larger, but definitely a rocky planet in the habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone of Proxima Centauri, which is way, way closer to the sun, or way, way closer to their star than the Earth is to our star, just because of how dim the Proxima Centauri star is. But it is a rocky world. It's in the habitable zone. We don't know yet if it's got an atmosphere or if it's got water or anything else about it, really. But it's a huge thing because that is probably the best place we've seen so far for location and terrain to support a human colony in another solar system.
Which is exciting. And the point of these exoplanets, and why we're hearing more about them as time goes on, is that we haven't been able to detect these things in the past. To detect an exoplanet, what scientists are doing is they're looking through a telescope and they're looking at a star. For detecting other objects that are also massive, kind of like a Jupiter-type planet, you can also look at the wobble of a star. If it wobbles a little bit due to the gravitational forces, but with a small planet like an Earth-type planet, you can't rely on that. You're actually looking at the star, and you're seeing if you can see like a dimness change as the planet goes past it. And so it's essentially like you're looking into a giant spotlight from hundreds of miles away to try and detect a mote of dust that's floated across it. And so just in the past, we haven't been able to detect those sorts of things, but our technology as it evolves, and I'm really excited when we get the James Webb telescope up and running, because that's going to give us a whole other level of capability of mm-hmm. being able to detect these sorts of things. Essentially why you're hearing about them now, and they haven't been as well known in the past, even though the manned exploration and discovery of another world has been something that we've been pondering about since the dawn of time.
Yep. So Proxima Centauri is a really tempting target. Additional ones that are in our sights are Bernard Star, Cirrus, Epsilon Eridani, which has two asteroid belts, which would be ideal for mining resources, because undoubtedly that would have a lot of the heavy metals that we need in order to fashion replacement parts or colonies. Tau Ceti, which we think has five planets, but we know that two of them are in the habitable zone of that star. We don't know a whole lot about them or pretty much any of the other ones, really, since all we know is that they're there and that they're in the correct area to be in the habitable area. Wolf 1061, which is in the habitable zone, possibly has liquid water based off of the signals that they've detected from it. Gliese, I can never pronounce that word. Gliese 581, which they think might have exoplanets in the habitable zone, but we're not 100% sure yet. Gliese 667c, which has six planets that we know about, and three of them are the big rocky super-Earths that are in their habitable zone, so that's pretty cool. And the star system Vega is currently working on planet formation. It's still in the state where it's got a lot of dust floating around the star that's very slowly colliding with each other and clumping together into planets, much like our system was over 4 billion years ago. So
that's exciting just to look at and learn about how that all came together and be. It's just exciting.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's probably going to be a little bit too long of a wait for us, but it's still cool to see that maybe one day we could settle there.
Maybe one day. And this habitable zone that we keep talking about, too, it's not necessarily a guarantee. If you look at, and depending on which magazine of science that you're looking at or which university did the study, the habitable zone for our solar system extends basically from the orbit of Venus, just outside the orbit of Venus, to include the orbit of Earth, of course, and just outside of the orbit of Mars. And so within that, you have essentially, well, Venus is just on the outside of it, but you have Venus, Earth, and Mars, which are very different planets.
Yeah.
And only one of them obviously has life. But that's the habitable zone for our solar system. So it's suffice to say, in another solar system, you might not necessarily have an Earth-like planet. We just kind of are hoping that perhaps something could exist there, namely water, which is how we basically figure this nonsense out.
If we got water and we have a way to produce electricity, we are good to go.
Yeah. And I mean, assuming the fact that that's habitable for our type of life as we know it. I mean, shoot, silicon-based life forms out there, that is a whole nother topic for another time.
Yep. So, last part that we're going to leave off on when we get there, are we going to be able to hack it? Simulations seem to say yes. The Hawaiian Mars simulation, the High Seas, just finished up last week or perhaps right before last weekend. And that was six scientists. They spent a year in isolation out in Hawaii. They basically pretended they were on Mars for the entire time. They lived in a dome with very, very little in the way of privacy. They ate like dried food and basically the stuff that you would eat rations-wise on a space mission. They breathed recycled air that was being pumped in their airtight dome. They could only leave the dome if they donned a full spacesuit to walk around out on the surface of Hawaii. and basically just tried to see what it would be like to live in a dome on Mars for a year. Obviously, they are a little bit less concerned as people on Mars would be, because if the dome breaches, they all know they're going to be fine. On Mars, that would be a constant source of anxiety, because if the dome breaches, you're all going to die. So, or breaches in some irreparable way. But they were able to get through the simulation just fine. There were no huge interpersonal problems, and everybody stayed psychologically fit throughout the entire exercise. So that is a really, really good indication that we might be able to actually do this whole staying on another planet thing with trained professionals.
And it might sound silly that we're looking at this as something as such, of such severity, just people getting along. But no kidding. That is a huge, huge part of the human factors. It's just people maintaining their sanity and being able to work together in confined spaces. We as a species are terrible at doing that. And so overcoming this to be able to accomplish these objectives and goals of going to other planets is no small feat. And it's impressive that we're able to do that.
Yep, indeed. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for sticking with us through this long episode, and welcome to Season 2. Hope to talk with you all more about some cool space topics over the next few weeks. So, once again, I'm the Pusher Robot.
And I'm the Shover Robot.
And you have gone
down the stairs.